Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Perron. Child soldiers have long been a feature in the various ethnic conflicts in Burma, recruiting young and forced to fight. Nobody knows exactly how many child soldiers there are. And despite an agreement last year, the United Nations says Burma's military is still signing underage boys. If an underage recruit or his family can contact an international aid group, they can petition the government for a discharge. But the December 1st deadline for removing all child soldiers from Burma's military has come and gone without any improvements. James Oten has the story.
Min Tu was only 12 years old from an impoverished family when he was promised a new life with a steady income and regular meals. The claims of a decent career in the army fell short of reality.
The food they fed us was so bad. They tortured us and swore at us. They were so unfair to us. If we did something wrong, they never tolerated it and started slapping or beating us.
During his four-year stint, Tu spent his days carrying supplies and working on army-owned farms. His promised $30 a month income was regularly taken by his superiors, and he was thrown into combat with little training.
There were many soldiers from both sides who got shot or lost body parts because of the fighting. I was so scared to see them, I ran away from that place and lay down under a bush.
Tu is one of around 500 child soldiers discharged in recent years, but many remain.
There is improvement. It is not yet fixed. And we are seeing still, for various reasons, boys in Myanmar, no girls, but boys being recruited into the military underage.
This mother is still waiting for the return of her underage son.
It is unbearable for me to think about this. I can't even imagine that they took my underage child to the army. How can they be so cruel?
It's a story familiar for Dorwin Sain.
I'm so worried something will happen to him. I don't know what to do or who to worship to get my son back.
Yet another problem to be solved as Myanmar moves further away from military regime to representative democracy.
An Australian lawyer representing East Timor in its spying case against Australia says his office has been raided by the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation and accused the agency of muzzling a key witness. Bernard Kalari says a number of agencies' electronic and paper files Tuesday afternoon from his law practice in Canberra. He gave the ABC's Emma Balarici more details.
So tell us, first of all, what were those ASIO agents looking for and what exactly was taken in the raid?
Well, there are many files taken. My correspondence with the East Timor government, the Prime Minister of East Timor, Chinana Gusmao, my correspondence with the learned professors in Cambridge and Oxford who are assisting and are the leading counsel in the case, Sir Elu Lauterpak and Professor Vaughan Lowe, counsel who are of the most eminent status in international law, a variety of other documents and records. Now, the Attorney General, Brandis, suggests that he can separate the two issues. That's a nonsense. This is an attempt to intimidate our witness and to prevent the evidence going forward at The Hague of this conduct.
Will that be achieved?
Well, of course it won't. I can't think of anything more crass than what has occurred. I mean, we go back to 2004 when the present Director General of ASIO was then the newly appointed from Foreign Affairs Director of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service when he ordered a team into Timor to conduct work which was well outside the proper functions of ASIS. Our Australian people don't expect their espionage service to be assisting revenue deliberations and commercial negotiations between partners. East Timor and of course, as your viewers know, and Australia were joint partners in this enterprise. There was a dispute about the revenue split, and the responsible minister, Alexander Downer, responsible also for the ASIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, brought about a situation where the internal negotiation deliberations of the East Timorese was bugged, eavesdropped, listened. This had nothing to do with our national security, nothing to do with protecting Australian people. All it's done is to drag our name down in face of the world once again.
Just by way of background, if you don't mind, Bernard Collieri, just giving us a little bit of context here for those who aren't familiar with the case, what is the evidence you'll be presenting in The Hague in relation to exactly how Australia went about this spying that you allege on East Timor?
This director, newly arrived director, sent a technical team into Dili to liaise with a Australian aid construction team that were effecting renovations in the nation-building idea in East Timor, renovations to rooms that were to be used for by the Timorese Prime Minister and his colleagues. Eventually, through a series of clandestine missions, bugs were inserted into hollow wall and for the actual negotiations that took place, there was a listening post, a transcript was carried across town, and so Mr. Downer's negotiators knew what the internal deliberations, as the issues went for over a period of days, knew what the Timorese were thinking, and that gives an extraordinary advantage. Emma, if this had happened in Wall Street, in Collins Street, Melbourne, in Bridge Street, Sydney, people would go to jail. This is inside trading to get extra revenue. It had nothing to do with protecting our country. It was over what is, in relative terms, a small amount of gas and oil, very valuable to the Timorese, but a minute, minuscule proportion of our national reserves. But when I come back to that unprecedented activity, and we've got someone coming forward to say, this was not in my proper functions of my service, you've got a very informed comment. Who ordered that program? Mr. Irwin. Who's in charge of ASIO? Sent his agents into my office and my home? Mr. Irwin. Now, I want Mr. Irwin to know this. That
you
we'll
mean,
see
you
who
mean David
turns
Irvine.
Out on the right...
Apologies for interrupting, yes.
Yes, I mean David Irvine, currently head of ASIO, who after his newly arrived appointment in ASIS in 2004 ordered this operation. Now, Mr. Irvine better consider about who is going to be, in the end of this day, on the right side of the law.
How legal and indeed how safe is it for ASIS to use Australian aid workers, as you're suggesting, as a cover for spying?
Well, this is what was done, and which makes it so horrible. We have Mr. Howard in his memoir saying how proud he is, and justifiably so in many respects, for what he's done for East Timor. You've got a massive amount of our wonderful troops who I saw there over the years, our wonderful volunteers and non-government people, and you've got this little operation, a sinister little sneaky operation besmirching our country's name and helping to keep this country poorer. If Mr. Irvine could go to East Timor and see the constant infant burials, he'd understand how strongly many of us feel about this conduct. Most improper conduct, outside the proper functions of ASIS, and we've got a situation where the man who ordered it is now the man who ordered a raid on my home and my office and other good persons.
What can you tell us about the witness who's been questioned tonight? We understand he is a former ASIS agent. Was he directly involved in spying on East Timor, the spying that you're alleging?
This witness was the director of all technical operations of ASIS. We're not talking about some disaffected spy. We're talking about a very senior, experienced, decorated officer who formed a proper view as would any good person, that this was a wrong operation. This was wrong, it was commercially motivated, and it was motivated in a situation where the government was anxious to give Woodside Petroleum a window of opportunity. I believe that's in our evidence. The case will be mounted in due course, and I think Australians should await judgment. But I want the documents returned from my office, and I certainly want Mr. Irvine to be closely scrutinised over this affair.
We understand the witness has had his passport seized. Were you expecting him to give evidence in The Hague?
If Australia was going to cease its neither confirm nor deny, of course, Emma, you should know that the Prime Minister of East Timor wrote to Julia Gillard in December last year and pointed out this evidence and gave Australia the opportunity to simply tear up this improperly procured treaty. It would have gone away at that stage. Timor's not joining this bandwagon of intelligence leaks and the rest. This is not part of what's currently going on. This is a well-developed, well-advised, eminently represented legal case against Australia. And it will proceed, Emma. Let me make clear to you and to Senator Brandis, this proceeding will continue. The evidence is available here in The Hague as I speak. Muzzling the oral evidence of the prime witness is so crass. What do you think the tribunal's going to think of it?
Well, isn't it
entirely... It's a contemptuous action.
Isn't it entirely within the rights of the Australian government to attempt to protect the integrity of its intelligence agencies and the information they collect in the course of their operations?
Indeed, Emma, but I made clear at the start there's no objective here in beating ASIS over the head. This is a wrong operation, clearly disagreed to within ASIS, which is a significant issue, and this witness is not providing evidence at large about operations of ASIS, and Australia would know if it had, and it hasn't. Nothing else is coming out of this case but that there was an operation in league with aid programs to construct listening devices into the walls of a building in Timor to be used by the new government. What threat to Australia's intelligence integrity does that disclosure give? What it requires is a full judicial inquiry into the conduct of ASIS in relation to this matter. Does the Australian public support the use of our intelligence service to adjust the revenue in revenue negotiations over this petroleum and gas oil field? After all, you should ask the Australian government just how much money did it personally get as an Australian government out of this clandestine mission. You'll find most of the money went to the oil company that was most advantaged by it. Will be advantaged by it, I should say.
Former Foreign Minister Alexander Downer says these recent spying allegations by East Timor against Australia are, in his words, an opportunistic attempt to undermine a treaty between the two countries over these lucrative gas fields in the Timor Sea.
This is a David and Goliath situation. This is a small country that has... it's an infertile country, marine clay, it grows very little. This gas and oil is its future. This is nothing opportunistic. The investigation and negotiation of this issue has been underway for some time. Most unfortunately, our litigation timetable has come up at the same time as the other spying disclosures, but this is totally unrelated to that.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Hundreds of demonstrators marched through the streets of Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby, in support of West Papuan independence. PNG is home to thousands of Papuans who fled Indonesia's rule, and there is widespread support for the independence movement. Port Moresby's governor, Paulus Pakoff, defied the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, and raised the province's Morning Star flag. The demonstration coincides with a visit by the controversial Papuan independent leader Benny Wenda and Australian human rights lawyer Jennifer Robinson. Both have been threatened with deportation from PNG and say they are told that their visit was ruffling feathers in Indonesia. We have this story from Liam Fox.
There was a mood of defiance in Port Moresby. Police told several hundred West Papuans and their PNG supporters not to march through the city, but march they did. Their destination was City Hall, where Port Moresby's governor raised the Morning Star flag of the West Papuan independence movement.
Papuan Indonesians, for the last 50 years, we have been silent, blind, not seeing, not hearing, not speaking. But tomorrow it must change.
It's believed to be the first time the flag's been raised at a government building in PNG. The Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, had asked the governor not to do it.
We are not a banana republic under Indonesian control.
Tens of thousands of West Papuans fled here to escape persecution by Indonesian authorities. Their struggle for independence is a sensitive issue. The government tries to balance local support for their cause while maintaining good relations with Indonesia. The arrests of three West Papuan activists highlights that sensitivity. Immigration officials have also threatened to deport visiting West Papuan activist Benny Wender and Australian human rights lawyer Jennifer Robinson. They're here to launch a renewed campaign for independence, but immigration officials say they're engaging in political activity.
I think it's a grave concern that Indonesia has such influence on domestic matters within Papua New Guinea.
Despite the arrests and the threats of deportation, West Papuans and their PNG supporters say the fight for self-determination will continue.
That was Liam Fox reporting. A United Nations human rights expert says it's time for the Vietnamese government to ensure better freedom of expression in order to prevent artists from being arbitrarily punished, harassed, or detained. The UN Special Rapporteur on Cultural Rights, Farid Shaid, has just returned from a fact-finding visit to Vietnam, where she met with government officials and members of the civil society. Ms. Shaid says she's received testimonies from various artists, many of whom said they are being harassed and in some cases imprisoned. And she says while the country has seen rapid economic development and reduced poverty, the areas of tourism, mega development are being negatively impacted. She speaks next to Tom Maddox.
Well, my impression from the visit that I conducted was that there is a lot of activity in civil society, amongst artists, as well as other people, and they're willing and wanting to participate in the formulation and development of their country. It seems to me that there is more space, from what everyone was saying, than there has been previously, but the parameters of how much space is available to say what is uncertain, and people find that there is a not enough sufficient definition of where those parameters lie, and therefore they sometimes cross the boundaries without really realizing that they've crossed the boundaries.
So who is it up to establish those parameters?
I think it's really up to the government to specify. They have constitutional provisions for the freedom of expression, they have freedom of association, and they have just recently, while I was there, moved the constitutional human rights section from Chapter 5 to Chapter 2, so a little more prominent. I think it's time for the government to really ensure that the spaces available are expanded and that people are not arbitrarily, you know, face punitive action or harassment for expressing themselves.
Last month, Vietnam, along with China, Russia, and other alleged rights abuses, gained seats on the UN Human Rights Council. Rights groups say this is a disgrace, highlighting alleged crackdown on activists, bloggers, journalists, artists. I understand following your trip, you share the concern that these figures in Vietnamese society are being harassed, watched, and detained in some cases. Is that right?
That is the testimonies I've received from a number of people that I met. Of course, I met with a lot of government officials who look after the area of culture and look after cultural heritage, who looked after various aspects of education and development. I also met with civil society and actors, musicians, writers, poets, curators of shows, people who are visual artists, and a number of them seem to be facing harassment, yes. They do not say that this is necessarily people from the government in terms of being identified, but the harassment is definitely there. And a number of the poets have been picked up and are imprisoned and sentenced. And this is something of concern, because I think that artistic expression is necessary in order for there to be a vibrant cultural life in any society, and that includes Vietnam.
In your preliminary findings, you were impressed by the progress made in poverty reduction and, more broadly, economic development. Why are these things receiving priority over people's expression?
Well, I think that given that there was a stage at which Vietnam had 70% of its population was below the poverty line, I think it's understandable that the priority should have been to ensure that the population had the basic needs that they required. And I think the government has done very well with that, following their Doi Moi, which was an economic reform policy that was started a couple of decades ago. Now I think they're at a juncture where Vietnam really has to consider that there are many things that have happened in between. Since then, the development of the country has also led to a lot of creative expressions. And I think that's something they need to look at in terms of development, just the potential negative impact of mega projects, the potential negative impact of tourism. I think this is a very good time for them to actually be reconsidering which direction they want to take this further. In terms of tourism, for instance, I was in the area of Sapa, and while certainly the measures taken have ensured that the population there has a supplementary source of livelihood, which is very important in a very impoverished and rural, remote area, I do not think at the moment the local people are the primary beneficiaries, and I think this is something that needs to be reconsidered.
And finally on the program, more and more students from India are heading to countries like Russia, China, Nepal, and Belize to obtain medical degrees. Cheaper medical education in these countries is attracting many aspiring doctors who cannot afford the steep costs of private medical education in India and are unable to make it to the limited seats in government medical colleges. Maruri Krishnan has the story.
Fascination for foreign medical degrees, coupled with big currency, has always been a strong motivation for Indian students. But rising fees for medical colleges in India and lack of proper healthcare infrastructure has now led to the flight of an increasing number of students abroad. According to the National Board of Examinations, the number of applicants has shown an upward trend since 2007. From approximately 5,000 candidates, that number has gone up to 14,000 now annually. China, followed by Russia, Ukraine and Nepal, are the favored destinations. Dr. Srinath Reddy is the president of the Public Health Foundation of India.
We are not going to be well served by this trend. We do have a shortage of doctors in this country. Particularly, doctors are maldistributed, both in terms of the medical colleges which train them and later on in terms of their location for employment.
Over 52 Chinese universities are offering the course at almost half the cost in India, and this includes at least three-star kind of lodging and boarding facilities. Many who have studied abroad enter the Indian health system after clearing the screening tests meant for foreign medical graduates. However, the percentage of students allowed to practice in India has stayed close around 25%. Last year, it touched 28%, with 4,000 of the 14,000 students who sat for the exam clearing it. Parul Kamath, a student, is looking forward to a stay in China.
I think I'll have a better future if I do my medical education in China, because education in private colleges in India is very expensive and I can't afford it. So when I come back, I'll have better job prospects after doing my medical education in China.
India's nearly 290 medical schools can admit up to over 31,000 students every year, while over 350,000 students sit for admission tests. The demand for admission to medical schools is clearly higher than supply. Dr. K.K. Agarwal, an office bearer of the Indian Medical Association, believes that medical seats need to be increased.
I hope Indian government thinks and comes out with more medical colleges and more seats so that students from India doesn't have to go to other countries. Let other countries' people compete to come in our country, but not Indian people going abroad to get a degree and come back. I don't think so that's the right approach, and I hope Medical Council of India will think about it and increase the number of seats.
Dr. Reddy, too, thinks this has to happen, but cannot predict a time frame.
The health ministry is indeed attempting to increase the number of seats in government medical colleges and is also encouraging the private medical colleges to do the same, of course, without relaxing the standards of education. How quickly this is going to happen is difficult to foresee.
Data from the World Health Organization shows that the doctor-to-patient ratio in India is 6 to 10,000, compared with 14 to 10,000 in China and 26 to 10,000 in the U.S., Dr. Reddy makes a larger point.
It is an urgent need, but I would also say that we should not purely depend on a doctor-centric medical system or a health system. We need to train many more nurses. We need to train many more allied health professionals, the paramedics of various categories, and have a multi-layered health system in which there are specialist doctors, basic doctors, and all of them need to be trained in adequate numbers because there are gaps everywhere.
As India continues to wrestle with the need to increase medical seats and colleges, the exodus also carries on.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. We'd like to hear what you think of the program, and if you have any story ideas, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until then, so long, and take care.